We hear a lot about what it means to be Black in America, but what does it mean to be white? How did the idea of whiteness as a human classification even come about? Today we learn from Kelly Brown Douglas, Dean of the Episcopal Divinity School at Union Theological Seminary, about the role of whiteness in America's racial history and about our Christian responsibility in the context of whiteness. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Church Next podcast. We're very glad to be back. Today, we're going to hear from Kelly Brown Douglas on whiteness and racial justice. Kelly is Dean of the Episcopal Divinity School at Union Theological Seminary. She's one of the foremost voices in the Episcopal Church today on race, and her research focuses on womanist theology. Womanism is a rich term that I will summarize here for those unfamiliar with it. It means an approach to the world that celebrates femininity experienced through the lens of Black culture. And she also writes on sexuality and the Black church. A well-respected author and lecturer, Dr. Brown Douglas's most recent book is Sexuality in the Black Church, A Womanist Perspective. She also wrote Stand Your Ground, Black Bodies and the Justice of God. Our podcasts are curated from our online learning library at churchnext.tv. You can learn more about us there, and if you'd like to support us, please consider a $9 monthly subscription. That will give you access to all of our individual online classes. Your generosity helps us produce digital experiences that help shape disciples. As you are all well aware, no doubt, we are living in a time of unrest. Americans of all races are talking, arguing, protesting in response to the U.S.'s current approach to race relations, and people are frustrated, and the time is chaotic and ripe with potential for change, with people engaging in protests in cities across the world, as well as across the U.S., in the wake of the murder of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minneapolis. White Americans and Americans of other races have been forced to acknowledge the violence that Black Americans face on a daily basis, as recent history confirms. Before George Floyd was murdered, for example, Dylann Roof killed 9 people in a historically Black church in Charleston. Trayvon Martin was shot by a civilian for essentially being Black in a white neighborhood, and his shooter was acquitted. People are becoming energized. They're standing up and refusing aloud to accept the status quo. People are thinking and writing, talking and reading and drawing cartoons, creating art in response to the racial upheavals of our time. Kelly Brown Douglas believes that we are living in what she calls a Kairos time, a time when God is moving through history, creating disruption, opportunity for important changes in how people interact both with God and with one another. And in this time of transition, we can choose to relapse into business as usual, or we can use the disruption to grow and to change. In today's podcast, Kelly Brown Douglas discusses the concept of whiteness, what it means to be white in America. She goes into the historical reasons for white privilege and ways in which our current systems develop to privilege whites at the expense of non-whites. And she discusses God, God moving through our history to redeem those who are subjugated and beaten down. God sustaining Black Americans through centuries of oppression. God moving through our time today to offer us a better way of living and of relating to one another. In her first talk, Kelly discusses whiteness as a constructed social order. She argues that the men who developed the American political and legal structures did so under the basic principle that the white body was superior. The Black body was property. With whiteness come certain privileges that have come to seem basic and unquestionable to many of us, in part because of their deeply ingrained presence in our governmental and legal structures.
Well, whiteness is a cherished attribute. Sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois talked about the wages of whiteness, that certain privileges come with being white. And perhaps the greatest of those privileges is the privilege to free space, the privilege to own one's own labor, and the privilege to own one's own body, the privilege to exclude. And so these are the privileges that come with the attribute of being white. And this is why I speak of whiteness as cherished property. What we know is that America isn't purely an Anglo-Saxon nation. America is an immigrant nation. And those who would come from Europe are indeed immigrants and not all Anglo-Saxon. To make a long story short, what happens is that whiteness in so many respects steps in to protect that Anglo-Saxon heritage. And so if one isn't white, then one can't sort of get on the other side of the line of what it means to be this chosen people. So whiteness becomes the marker. When you have founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson, who were thoroughgoing Anglo-Saxonists. Thomas Jefferson even wrote a letter, I believe, to his granddaughter in which he suggested that Tacitus' book, Germania, which is where he develops his Anglo-Saxon myth, was one of the best books ever written. And so Thomas Jefferson really wanted Anglo-Saxon language to be a part of university curricula. He really wanted to make sure that we stay true to Anglo-Saxon institutions, political institutions. And so he was a thoroughgoing Anglo-Saxonist, and so much so to the point we know that Thomas Jefferson had very, in this day and age, we would say bigoted views toward non-white bodies. And indeed, in his notes to Virginia, he often articulated very biased and negative views in terms of the black body, comparing them to orangutans, for instance. And so Thomas Jefferson, what we know of our founding fathers is that they too were very steeped in this idea that the Anglo-Saxon, that the white body was the superior body. And in so many respects, this country, the democracy that this country is founded on, freedom and justice and life and liberty to all, was never intended for the non-white body. It was never intended for the black body. And so that which, of course, reinforces this ideal is what we've seen in history, and that is chattel slavery. The black body, by and large, was introduced into this country as chattel, as property. Chattel meaning belonging to another. It was never meant to have the freedom of its own labor, the freedom of its own body, the freedom of space. That privilege was the privilege of whiteness. And so that's what we began to see, is that whiteness stands for certain privileges, that is, freedom, and blackness begins to symbolize that which is unfree. What we see is that whiteness becomes a racialized social construction. And one of the things that we see in the country today, and I'm digressing a little bit, and I'll get back to your question, but one of the things that we see today is that one of the privileges of whiteness is that white people don't understand that they too are raced. And they are raced with the whiteness of privilege. And of course, black people are raced with the blackness of penalty, of lack of privilege. And so with the construction of whiteness, and whiteness is constructed to stand over and against that which is non-white. It is that idea that those who are white, those who have the greatest connection, let's say, to the Anglo-Saxon heritage and Anglo-Saxon myth, that those are a privileged people. Now, the thing about whiteness is that it only makes sense in relationship to that which is non-white, right? Because we know that as an artificial sort of social, and even though it's a social construct and an artificial construct, doesn't mean that it's any less insidious or intractable or impactful. But as a social construct, we know that when we talk about white people, we are talking about a people of a diverse heritage. But as James Baldwin said in his book, Price of the Ticket, a funny thing happened on the way to America. He says that once white people came to America, they came as Italian Americans, they came as Irish Americans, they came as German Americans, so to speak. But when they came here, they became white. A white hegemony developed so that they could understand themselves as a group over and against those that they had already dubbed as inferior, the non-white body initially. Those were the natives of this country, the Indians, and then, of course, the black body. And so you always had this white hegemony, and if you couldn't cross the line of whiteness, then, of course, you weren't entitled to certain privileges. We'll be right back.
Kelly goes on to examine the relationship between Christianity and slavery in her second talk. And that relationship is complex. Christianity has been invoked by historians as a force white people used to justify slavery, and is one that motivated slaves to put up with slavery patiently instead of rebelling. But it also stood as a support that helped slaves endure slavery, and a force that threatened and undermined slavery to the point that slave masters preferred to keep slaves ignorant of the Bible. So Kelly discusses the sort of self-contradictory role of Christianity in both supporting and undermining slavery.
And sure, it just suggests that the way things are is the way God intended them to be. Natural law suggests, of course, that there is an eternal law or a divine law for which we as humans are to comply. And it suggests that, you know, God created the world to be a certain way and for people to have a certain place in society. And so our human law is meant to reflect that eternal law. And so what we see when we see, for instance, what's happening in our society and in our world and what's happened in relationship to race and this narrative of white superiority is that it has been suggested that the status quo, and that is white superiority, white domination, that is a reflection of natural law. That is a reflection of the way in which God intended things to be. And to step outside of that, to step outside of your role, your status, well, that again is a breach, and which means it's sin. And so, for instance, for black people to step outside of their natural order of being subordinate to white people, well, that's a sinful act. And if we saw that articulated even more clearly, of course, during the time of slavery. And so that, again, black people's natural role was to always be subordinate to white people and to be slaves. And so a natural, what I call sort of this natural law ideology emerged. And it emerged from sort of structures of white power that suggested, well, this is the way things black people were created to be slaves. Well, you just construct other kind of laws and systems and structures that maintain that reality. One of, if I can jump ahead to contemporary times to today, one of the systems that does that, of course, is the industrial prison complex. And so we create laws, such as the drug laws, that indeed land, trap black bodies, and place them back into an unfree space. I call the prison industrial complex the new slavocracy, because it places the black body where it was intended to be, back into a chattel space. The black chattel morphs into the black criminal. And so while you are no longer saying that, oh, black people were created to be slaves or black people were not created to be free, what you do is you create laws, systems, and structures that indeed make that a reality. And then you suggest things such as the fact that, well, you aren't going to say that black people are innately criminal, but you began to create images and stereotypes, and when you show the black body and black people on the news in other kind of portrayals of black people, you always see them in negative ways. There are negative portrayals, and so you lift up the black criminal. And so you create, again, within the collective consciousness of America, this idea of the criminal black body, this ideal of the criminal black male, and this ideal of the angry black woman. And so you don't have to say directly anymore that, well, look at them, this is who they are, who they're created to be. You just create that reality. And that's what we have. And so that it is hard for people, there's almost this unconscious response that you immediately believe, well, that black guy must have been guilty of something. Or you immediately feel threatened in the presence of a black male. Well, he must have had a gun. Why must he if he had a gun? Well, he's a black male, isn't he? And so you see a gun. And I'm not suggesting that some of these people didn't act with malintent that shot these innocent black kids, but we also know that we have created within the collective consciousness of this country this idea that the black male body is threatening, so that you automatically think you see a gun. These are the ways in which we began to see in an insidious and subtle way this whole idea of natural law is still present, because you really begin to think, well, just look at them. You know, the statistics prove that they are the way we say they are.
One aspect of Christianity that moves many people to worship is its identification with those whom society demeans and exploits. The children of Israel, for example, are slaves and they're nomads. And for a brief point in history, they gain power, but then they're conquered and dispersed by the Babylonians. And they are God's beloved. Jesus is born to powerless people in an occupied nation. He is persecuted by the powerful members of his society almost from birth. He lives much of his adult life as an itinerant preacher, and he is crucified with criminals, but he is God incarnate. In this third portion of our podcast, Kelly discusses God as an advocate for freedom for each individual to realize their potential to live full lives as God's children. And she explores ways in which their faith in God has supported Black people in America through the many oppressions that they've faced, and how their awareness of their value as children of God has given them a sense of identity outside the context of white contempt.
What becomes clear, and it became clear to even the black enslaved as they began to understand and take on what it meant to be Christian, it becomes clear that that God identified with the least and the lowliest of society, the oppressed, the suffering. Jesus on the cross, the enslaved used to sing this song, poor little Jesus boy, born in a manger, world treat him so mean, treat me so mean too. And so they began to understand that God wasn't on the side of the crucifiers. God was on the side of the crucified. And what does that mean? That means that God hears the pain, the suffering is moving with the crucified, moving with the oppressed, moving as they struggle to be free. And of course, in the Black faith tradition, the crucifixion and the resurrection go together, because the resurrection is the triumph, right, over those crucifying realities. The other indication of that, which is something that slaveholders tried to keep away from the enslaved, first of all, the Bible, and certainly the Bible, because the Bible told the story of the Exodus. A God that was on the side of the Israelites as they were moving toward freedom. God didn't come down and say, I see the Egyptians and they're trying to impress the Israelites, let me help them. God said, I hear and see the cries of the Israelites and oppressed people, set my people free. And so something that was understood and is very clear is that God's for freedom. Freedom from anything that would thwart the ability of a people to live into the fullness of who they are. And so when you look at who God is, as God revealed himself, God revealed God's self through Jesus, when you look at the revelation of God in history in relationship to the Exodus story, well, you see a God of freedom, a God on the side of the oppressed, a God who points us to a different reality. And so that's what I hang my hat on as a theologian. And the a priority thing to that is that every single human being, until someone shows me differently and can prove differently to me that every single human being who has breath is a sacred child of God, regardless. We are all created in the image of God, created for life, created out of love, created to love. And so unless someone shows me differently, I believe that to be the case. And so it is meant for us to live into the meaning of what it means to be a child of God. We can't expect systems and structures that were not intended to be for everyone to morph into becoming systems and structures that are intended to be for everyone. And so it's not about trying to gain the privilege, for instance, and the power that white males have in this country. It's about dismantling the systems and structures that indeed give certain people undue privilege and undue power and give other people unjust penalty. And so I think what we have to do is not try to tweak certain things, we have to change them. Because certain things can't be tweaked. You know, we have to change our laws. We have to change the way the criminal justice system functions. We have to change our educational system. We set people up to go straight into the criminal justice system because we don't give them other options for living. We don't give them proper educational options. We don't give them proper recreational options. We don't give them housing options, et cetera, and employment options. And so we're setting them up. We've got to look at those things, and we can't say, oh, you know, just if these people just work harder, these things are fair. No, there's something systemically wrong. And so with our social economic structures and systems. And so that's what we mean. Well, no, we can't use the master's tools because it works for the master. Why would the master want to change them? And so we've got to step outside of those spaces, and we have to look as outsiders who are not within. We have to look at those outsiders who have no access to these systems and structures. And if we look through their eyes, we will begin to see the ways in which these things don't work and the ways in which they are automatically closed out.
Kairos is an ancient Greek word that indicates opportunity for change, a time when people have a chance to make action meaningful, to make a meaningful difference in their world. And Christians associate Kairos with God's creating that opportunity to enact change. The word suggests that our response to the present moment makes a difference, that the time provides the chance, but that our job is to seize it. And in her last talk, Kelly argues that the U.S. is currently experiencing a Kairos time. She enjoins us to seize the opportunity to build racial justice.
One of the things that has become clear to me, and clearer and clearer still, well after the book has been written, is that I really believe that this is what theologians have called a Kairos time in our history. And a Kairos time is a time, as some say, that is so pregnant with the possibilities for God and God's future, that God is present, disrupting things as they are, so to bring us to a different point of relationship with one another, with ourselves, and with God. And so that those times are often chaotic, often times of crisis, because they're times of disruption. And we can miss the Kairos, and we can just go back to the way things are. We can enjoy the false peace of injustice. Or we can claim the Kairos and see that this disruption is the non-peace, if you will, of injustice. And so we can say things have to change. And so I do believe that this is one of those moments, and that God is working to disrupt this unjust status quo of, in this instance, this racial injustice, to bring us to a different point of relationship, to begin to name racism in this country, and to name not simply this kind of surface racism of, you know, the politeness of the way we treat each other, but to name it at its roots, and to recognize why we keep replaying these moments over and over and over again in our history. So that's the first thing that I believe, that we have to read the sign of the times. And to read them theologically is to ask ourselves, how is God moving and working in these times, and God is moving to bring us to a different place. Not that God creates the deaths that we see, but that God can move through those deaths to get us to see something that is wrong with the world the way it is. The other thing that I believe when I talk about sort of keeping the faith and hope, that's the strength of the Black faith tradition. I am always moved by two statements by Trayvon Martin's parents. One, that his father said after the verdict of his, the acquittal of his son's killer, the father said that my heart is broken, but my faith is unshattered. And after that, his mother, Trayvon Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, said, God is still in control. And what that represented was Black faith at its finest, because Black faith was born in the context of Black oppression. It's almost a paradoxical faith. It continues to believe in the justice of God even in a world full of injustice, because Black faith says that the way things are isn't the way God intended them to be. Why do we know that? We know that because of the resurrection. And so that's the hope. And so if, indeed, sometimes I wonder where Black people would be without that faith, because it's that which allows you not to give in to the white racist hatred of the time and of the day, not to allow yourself to be defined by that, but instead to allow yourself to be defined by the sacredness of who you are as a child of God, and to believe in the justice of God, in that God's justice will indeed reign. And that's what keeps you going. Without that, I don't know. But the idea of a just God and a God that resurrected Jesus from the crucifying realities of his own day, that idea keeps you going, because you know, as Sabrina Fulton talked about,
that is the end of Kelly's talk for today. But if you're interested in learning more of her ideas about racial justice, women's bodies, the Black body, race in America, building racial justice in America, read her books. You might try Stand Your Ground, Black Bodies and the Justice of God. You might also consider other ChurchNext classes or podcasts in our racial justice series. They include Spirituality and Racial Justice with Michael Curry, Theology and Racial Justice with J. Cameron Carter, Racism and Racial Justice with Eduardo Bonilla Silva, and Reparation and Racial Justice with Jennifer Harvey. That winds us up for today. Thanks for tuning in, and let us pray. O God, in whose image the whole human family was created, we pray for all whose lives have been forever altered by racial violence. Grant us the strength to build a just society. In the name of God, the Father and Mother, the Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen.